Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and today we are going to zero in on identifying and preventing and treating plant diseases. Couple of guests for you today. One of our regular guests, Brian Huddleston, with us, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology. And Brian, great to have you back.
Glad to be back.
It's great to have you. And with us for the first time, Liz Freemuth, who was previously a horticulturist for Walworth County. That's right. I got that right.
Yes, you do.
And now you're the owner of The Garden Hole, a passion for healthy and happy plants. So it's a... Tell us about the concierge service.
Basically, yes, concierge horticulture services. I love doing the diagnostics in the field, taking a look at the symptoms that are occurring, what people can do to make their yards and plants healthier. But, you know, I answer all kinds of questions for people, and if I can't help them, I point them in the right direction.
Okay. And so you work with homeowners primarily or businesses as well?
Anybody who needs help with their plants. I've got clients that range businesses to large estates, privates. Yeah, all anybody.
Right. Well, I tell you what, it's great to have you here, and I want to give the number for our callers. If you're listening in, have a question about treating or preventing or identifying a plant disease, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And Brian, you know, we don't ask this very often, often enough, I don't think, but let's talk about that plant disease diagnostic clinic.
Sure.
So what do you folks do?
We basically look at any plant that's looking peaked or doesn't look quite right, and we try to figure out what the problem is and then send some information on the disease, if that's what it is, and how to control the problem. So we basically work with any type of plant other than turf. We have a specific turf diagnostic lab here on campus as well. So if it's a turf sample, it goes to them. Everything else comes to me. So right now I have potatoes, mandevilla, spruce trees, begonias in my lab right now.
Oh,
so I get a variety of things.
Do you ever get photos? Do people send you digital pictures sometimes? That makes it harder, I would
say. Yeah, for me, it's not as easy a task to do the diagnostics based on a photo. I like to get photos in addition to the plant sample, particularly if folks can take pictures of, it's a, say, a tree, what the tree
the
looks like
plant,
in the landscape.
Yeah.
That can be very helpful in terms of kind of tracking down exactly what the problem might be. Otherwise, sometimes I get branches that come in that are dead. I can't find anything, and I have this what I call my litany letter that I sent, which is a 2-page letter on particular things that they might need to look for. If I have those photos, I can sometimes focus in and say, oh, it looks like you have a girdling root around the base of the tree that may be contributing to the problem. But Phil Pelletieri, who you have on very often, really likes digital photos. He's able to identify insects, but a lot of what I need to look at is microscopic. So but definitely, folks are sending in samples, send both the plant, and if you have some photographs of what the plant looked like in the landscape, that's great.
And particular days to send that in. I know you point that out from time to time.
Definitely. Early in the week is better. The worst thing that can happen is for it to arrive at the post office over the weekend. We do get Saturday delivery, and sometimes I am in and I'll check our mail. But particularly on holiday weekends, if it comes over the weekend, basically it's going to sit. We like to get them as quickly as possible and then get them refrigerated so that they stay fresh. So the fresher the material, the better. Worse, probably on the sampling end of things, is if a sample is taken and then somebody throws it on their dashboard and lets it sit in the sun for a few days, I get what I call liquid in a bag, liquid sample in a bag. It's very interesting
Delicious.
To try to diagnose those. Yeah.
Oh, well.
Slime in a bag.
Well, on that note, let's turn to the phones. Mike in Sparta has a question for you guys, so let's go there. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Yes. I am having some problems with some of my seedlings this year with spindle rot. Is there anything you can do to prepare for this in advance?
Mm-hmm.
And if you do have it, what's the best thing you can do to get rid of it?
Okay, I'm going to ask you what you mean by spindle rot. I'm assuming what you're meaning is that you plant seeds, the seedlings come up, and then they kind of, the lower stems kind of collapse and they fall over. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's what we officially call damping off. And I haven't heard it called spindle rot, but I kind of like that name.
That is kind of cool.
Yeah,
I like that.
Cool. It is very descriptive. It's usually caused by several different soil-borne fungi. And some of the things that you can do is make sure you're using, when you're growing your or germinating your seeds, make sure that you are using a potting mix that's been pasteurized.
Okay.
And check the bag when you buy that. Do not bring in garden soil to start your plants indoors. So get a commercial potting mix. Make sure it is definitely pasteurized. It should say that on the bag. And what they do is they put steam through it, and that helps kill off disease-causing organisms that are in the soil. You probably want to add some material to that to kind of improve drainage a little bit, because these damping off fungi really like wet soils, and I think a lot of the commercial potting mixes are a little heavy. So add some perlite or vermiculite to that to kind of lighten it up a little bit. Do not overwater. And then the other thing, where are you starting your plants? In the
I've got them under Grolux bulbs.
Okay, in the basement or
Right.
That's where a lot of people grow, and it's a little bit cool down there. So what you may want to do is invest in, there are some apparatuses that you can buy that will actually heat your pots. And what you want to do is you want to germinate those seeds at as warm a temperature as possible, and get them to grow really fast, because the damping off fungi tend to infect only when the seedlings are really small. And then the seedlings, as they grow, will actually become more resistant to that disease. So you want to get them up and out of that susceptible phase as quickly as possible.
And get air on them.
And a lot of air to keep it a little bit on the drier side. Definitely make sure you don't overwater, because it's that those cool, moist conditions that are really going to favor this particular disease. Do you reuse pots at all?
No, I've been using fiber.
Okay.
Ones, and then I just throw them, them in the garden with them. And
definitely. For anyone in the audience who uses plastic pots, if you've had a damping off problem, I suggest you get rid of those plastic pots. You can try to decontaminate them by soaking the pots in about a 10 to 20% bleach solution for about 20 to 30 minutes. But what we find is that that treatment works better with clay or ceramic pots. With plastic pots, it just doesn't kill off everything that needs to be killed off.
There you go.
And I love Brian's recommendation that if you're going to disinfest plastic, it takes, what, 140 to 160 degrees?
Which I usually recommend incineration.
Above melting point of plastic.
I often joke when I give a talk that my preferred decontamination method for plastic is incineration. So
there you go, Mike. Thank you very much.
I have another question.
Oh, okay.
If I might, I have some arborvitae that are they're probably 15 feet high, and this past winter the deer were very hungry, and they really decimated a couple of my arborvitae. Is there any way that I can get to bring them back?
Just a little bit of care. You know, I'm I'm often quite surprised at how resilient those trees are. They're not going to look as good as they did before the deer did their business. So you're going to see probably a little bit fuller growth because they've nipped back all of those little branches. So wherever there was a growth point close to where they chewed, you're going to get new growth coming out. And it may be fuller. It's not going to be quite as far out. So the diameter of the canopy is not going to be as large. Not right away. So you may want to take a look at, can you prune those? Can you trim those back to kind of even them out a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
And if the deer have eaten on those this year, they will be back because they now know that that's a food source. So you need to take a look at what can you do to prevent the damage throughout summer and then going into next winter. So you're going to want to look at either changing their habits, and, you know, Scott Craven talks about that all the time, where, you know, there's products that you can put on, or, you know, just dissuade them from being there by surprise noises, et cetera, that will bother them. If you change their habits now, you may actually get through another winter or so. But I've been surprised. I've had trees completely and totally de-leafed over the winter down to where they look very, very columnar, and they actually grow leaves back on them, little needles back on them. So, you know, there is hope you'll get something. Just it's not going to
Look very good.
It's not going to look the same. Yeah, so you have to decide, what do I want to do? You know, it might be a time for shopping, too, shopping for some new trees to put in that the deer aren't going to bother.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And there are not a lot of trees that, well, there are some trees that a deer won't bother, but.
Yeah, well,
but you know, when they're hungry, there's
they'll eat anything.
Yeah, yeah. And even.
I love the name of Laura's, Joel's publication on this. It's plants not preferred by deer.
Exactly.
It's not resistant or ones they won't eat. It's they don't
prefer
them. Yeah.
Well, and you know, even I like that because she's very upfront about it. It's not that they aren't going to eat them. They just don't prefer those as first choice.
Right.
But as we know, as winter goes on, Yes, they're going to chew what they're going to chew. I've had them take out things that they aren't supposed to eat at all, period, and they will eat them to beat the band. Mm-hmm. Now, one tree, one arborvita, that cultivar that I have seen, it's a different species than the one that we have around here. It's Thuja plicata, and it's a Western arborvita. And there's one that's called Deer Proof that is an absolute phenomenon so far. The deer have not bothered it. I've put it in for clients in some pretty heavy deer feeding areas, and looks great all winter. It actually has better color than Spring Grove. That's another one that is somewhat deer resistant. Whether they develop a taste for it over time and in under really severe circumstances, I would guess yes. But for right now, I've had 5 winters, and this is a yard where there's 15, 20 deer all the time, and they have not bothered them. So that's a possibility. It's not foolproof, but it does work so far for us.
There you go. Thanks again, Mike, for calling. Talking, identifying, treating, and preventing plant diseases today with our two guests, Liz Freemuth, a horticulturist from formerly from Walworth County. She's now the owner of The Garden Hole, a passion for healthy and happy plants. And, of course, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. Join us with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Todd in Toma. Your turn. Yes, hi, Todd.
Hi. I have two questions. One is on how to take care of fire blight in apple trees. Mm-hmm. And my other question is, I believe it's called plum bloat. The plums swell up on the plum trees.
Yeah, it's...
and then they just fall off. And I'm wondering how to take care of both those.
Okay, sure. Let's start with fire blight. My first question for you is, how severe are you seeing a problem with fire blight?
Not real severe.
Okay.
Some of the young trees lost some young trees from it, but then the older trees is just here and there on the branches.
Okay. Are you sure? One, I guess, are you sure that it's fire blight? Have you had that confirmed? Because there are other diseases that look somewhat similar.
Pretty positive.
Okay.
The trunks are jet black, and the leaves will, the edges of them will turn all black, and then they finally just start to curl up.
Okay. And do they re-leaf the following year, or are those branches totally dead?
Yep, they'll re-leaf.
Okay.
Well, those branches, mm-hmm. they'll eventually die.
Okay. But
the rest of the tree will leaf.
So
the rest of the tree's leafing.
Okay, but those individual branches where you get the leaves dying, they are totally dead. They don't re-leaf the following year?
No, they don't.
They
might come out a little bit, maybe if I remember right, but for the most part, that branch ends up...
is dead. Are you seeing any oozing on the branches at all in the springtime where you see like a big mass of sap that will come out of the branch? That's sometimes typical of fire blight as well. I'm just trying to make sure that you really are dealing with fire blight before we talk about control.
Okay, I'm not sure, not a lot of the wheezing. I've read that on the wheezing of the fluids, and I don't really see that.
Okay, there are some other fungal diseases that could be causing that branch dieback as well, but let's just talk about branch dieback in general. We'll give some specific recommendations if it's fire blight, and then slightly different recommendations if it's something else. If it's fire blight, one of the things you want to do is catch that early and prune the branches fairly severely. What we normally recommend is try to look to see where you see kind of the edge of where the branches are dying. So if you see parts that have healthy leaves, and then it goes into an area of the branch where there are dead leaves, find that interface, and then go down about 12 inches below that and prune out the branch. And what you're trying to do is remove any of the branch that might be infected with the bacterium. And then between cuts, definitely you want to disinfest your tools. I would suggest dipping them in a 70% alcohol solution, and rubbing alcohol would be something that you could use for that. It's about 70%. The other thing that you can look into are some of the spray disinfectants. Just check the label to make sure that they're about 70% alcohol. And then you just spray those until the tools drip and then allow them to air dry. And then you want to get those branches that you've cut off out of your yard, away from your apple trees. If you have the option of burning them, that would be a good option. Otherwise, I would say try to bury them or get them to some place where they do hot composting. You want to get those branches away from the trees because the bacterium will stay active for a while after you've cut the branches out of the tree.
Can I ask you, are you really attached to these apple trees?
Yeah, that would be another question. That's another very good question.
What was the question?
Are you emotionally attached to these particular apple trees, or would you be willing to replace them?
Yes.
You would be really willing to replace?
Yes.
Then we talk about judicious pruning at the ground level, which means remove the tree and get a newer variety that has fire blight resistance.
Yeah.
Because that's if you are not attached to these specific trees, then I would say that's a better option for you. Because you'll have fewer problems long term, and there will be less maintenance for you in terms of that pruning. Because that pruning can get pretty time consuming if you've got a variety that is susceptible. So definitely consider that as an option. You may decide not to do that, but that definitely is an option if you're so inclined.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Todd. Talking plant disease today with Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemoth. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening in on this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemoth. Thank you again for listening. Call us with your plant disease questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. And, you know, we need to go back to our previous caller who had also asked a question about plums and plum bloat, I believe, is what he called
it. Yeah, if it's the disease I'm thinking of, it's one that I really like. I don't see it very often, but it's technically called plum pox. Oh, excuse me, take that back. Plum pockets, not plum pox. Plum pox is actually a nasty viral disease of plums. It's plum pockets. And it's actually, for those in the audience that may have heard of a disease called peach leaf curl, it's actually caused by a similar fungus. And it is a fungal disease. The fungus infects the fruits and causes them to get very, very spongy and very hollow in the center. And that's a situation where you may want to simply make sure that you clean up all of those spongy fruits. And then you may also want to come in either in the fall or in the spring, or perhaps both. So it'd be in the fall after the leaves fall from the tree, or in the spring before the tree leaves out, and come in with a application of some sort of copper fungicide that's labeled for use in plums. That particular fungus and its relative, the one that causes peach leaf curl, tend to overwinter in the wood on the branches. So the copper will help control it, and you can do that. Sometimes you need more than one application in order to get that under control, but it's a very distinctive disease. The other disease that we see that it might be also if the fruits were sort of buff brown and then eventually mummified, there's also a disease called brown rot. And that one, again, survives in the mummified fruits that fall onto the ground. So you need to scour the ground around your peach and plum trees for any of these mummified fruits and remove them. The fungus is in there. They'll sprout and form a little mushroom-like structure, and then the spores from there will reinfect new fruits. And a lot of the fruit sprays, if you're using fruit sprays on peaches or plums, will contain fungicides that will help control brown rot. But Last year, I saw a lot of that, or heard a lot of that from folks. They
last
talked
year
about
and
it.
The year before.
I think primarily because we had a very wet summer, both in 2009 and 2010. It was a great environment for that fungus to get established.
You know, frequently people will say, well, how do I get all those fruits up off the ground? Use a shop vac or use some sort of a leaf vac. That helps a lot because otherwise you are going to miss stuff. So you need to get that sucked up and off the ground.
Right.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Let's go to Lisa in East Troy. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
During one of the storms this past week, my enormous 100-year-old maple tree got hit by lightning. It doesn't appear from my viewpoint that it got, you know, too bad. It's not cracked. I don't see any big holes, but there's, you know, bark missing, not all the way down, but spiraling around the tree, and then kind of some trenches where it must have followed the ground coming out. Is there anything that I can do to help this tree survive, or do I just wait for a year and see if it can manage?
Basically, the thing that I would suggest would be to, if we get into droughty periods, make sure you're giving them the tree some extra water. You just want to kind of maximize its ability to grow and fight off the damage that's been done, and that involves the tree producing some callus tissue to cover over the wounds. So definitely don't stress it for water. If you need water, get a soaker hose, put it out near the drip line, or if you can water more extensively, definitely give it some supplemental water. We usually recommend about an inch of water for established trees. You might want to up that a little bit and 1 to 2 inches.
Okay.
And if we're not getting that from natural rain, get out there with a soaker hose or a drip hose and apply it around the drip line of the tree.
Okay.
And then it is kind of a waiting game because it really depends on how much damage there was on that tree.
How long will it take before I would know that? Do I need it? Because obviously it's budded out now and ready to go. But
right. It'll be hard to tell. If it's going to die rapidly, if there's enough damage, you may get some leaf set and then the leaves will collapse.
Okay.
Usually into June is usually when I start to see at least some of that when there's damage in the vascular tissue, the water conducting tissue. It could hang on and it might go through a rather slow and painful death.
Oh,
if it looks like it's not doing particularly well, you may want to kind of plan ahead and try to plant another tree in anticipation of losing that particular one.
Sometimes the leaves, don't they color out a lot earlier when they're
I would worry that there's so much extensive vascular damage that there'll be enough internally stored water to get those leaves pushed and out, but then it won't be able to take up additional water, then it'll totally collapse. If it's a less severe damage, you might get this early fall color that you're talking about. That's oftentimes a stress symptom.
And you may actually go through this year with relatively normal leaf out, depending on how severely the lightning actually hit it and did damage. What I would suggest is to hold off with fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
If that's something that you do, wait until fall.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Like 20 feet in diameter. It's like I said, it's about 100 years old. I don't know much to it at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it is a waiting game. Yeah, it is a waiting game. Do you currently work with an arborist for your yard?
I do not.
That's something that if you have mature trees that are valuable to the landscape, you may want to start searching for one that you can, develop a good relationship with so that you can get good advice when things like this happen. And I'm sure that you probably need to do some pruning also.
Okay, there you go. Good luck, and thank you very much. And you'd look for, certified?
Certified arborist. I would go to www.waa-isa.org. And that's the Wisconsin Arborist Association website, and there's a searchable section on that where you can find a certified arborist that works in your particular county.
But Judith will put that up on our Facebook page, so we've got people can go to the Facebook page.
That's a great website to have available.
It is, and it's like finding a doctor where you really have to develop a rapport with who's there working on your trees, and you need to do that before you actually need them. Otherwise, it can take up to 6-8 months to get an arborist on site.
Right. They tend to be very, very busy.
Exactly.
So we'll put that that site up on our Facebook page, Lisa. So just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and we'll have that for you. And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We have a question from, let's see who we got here. We've got a question from Peggy in Mondovi, who wonders about our tomatoes. They always get a fungus, kills the leaves from the bottom up, finally kills the plant by the end of the season. Of course, that reduces the tomato yield. It also affects other kinds of plants in the garden. Something I can do to stop it before this year's growing season.
Sure. I get this question all the time. In fact, when I was at Garden Expo, I think that was the question. It was just like a continuous repeat for the entire 3 days on that particular question.
Well, you know, people think tomatoes are very easy to grow. And so it's
and they can be in the right environment, but we've had wet summers the last two summers. And the disease that is being described here is probably one of the really common leaf diseases that we see on tomatoes. There are a couple of them. One's called early blight, not to be confused with late blight, which is another totally different story. In home gardens, the other disease that we see quite commonly is septorial leaf spot, and both of those will start, as the emailer suggested, at the bottom of the plant and work their way up. These are fungal diseases. The best thing to do to try to control those is to start with good fall cleanup. If you haven't cleaned up your old tomato plants at this point, it's time to get them out of your garden, and I would get that, either burn it, bury it. You can put it into a compost pile as long as you're composting properly. You need to have good heating, 140-plus degrees in that compost pile. You need to turn it regularly to get all of the material evenly heated and to decay that old tomato debris that gets rid of the fungus that causes the disease. When you come out this year to plant your tomatoes, I suggest moving them to a new area in the garden. That isn't as important for controlling these leaf diseases as some other techniques, but it does help prevent other more serious tomato diseases, so I recommend that routinely. When you put your tomatoes in, space them as far apart as you possibly can. You don't want a lot of overlap with the leaves, because what you want to try to do is promote good airflow between the plants so that when they get wet, they stay or get dry as quickly as possible. You don't want them to stay wet for a long period of time. So no overlap in the leaves. When you get them in, mulch around the base of the plants. And quite frankly, I would go back and mulch over the area where you had tomatoes last year. where these blight fungi tend to survive are in little bits of old tomato debris that have kind of filtered into the soil, and you want to put a physical barrier over the soil to prevent their spores from getting out of the soil into your plants. You can get resistant varieties if you want to. I'm not big on a lot of those because I don't think the fruit flavor is that great. There's some indication that genes for blight resistance and genes for flavors are closely linked on tomato chromosomes. So you either get a great tasting fruit with on a plant that's totally blighted or a really healthy looking plant that has pretty pasty tasting fruit. Let's see, your other things, don't overhead water. Definitely don't use a sprinkler. Use a soaker hose. If you're sprinkling, you're basically simulating rain, which gets the leaves wet, and definitely that can cause problems.
Over-fertilization.
Oh, yeah, you have to be careful with too much nitrogen because that'll actually decrease fruit set and will also produce a lot of dense foliage, which, again, tends to stay wet. You can prune up branches from the bottom just, again, to open up the airflow. There are fungicide treatments, but quite frankly, I recommend if you need to do that, go to your local farmer's market and buy them commercially. It's cheaper and easier and probably healthier, quite frankly.
And so, satisfying.
Yes.
Yeah, and satisfying as well. But you're right about the closeness. As I look at gardens, the one big mistake I see so often with tomatoes is that they're all
packed together. I've actually seen people try to like espalier them on wires, and actually I think that's not a bad idea because it, again, opens up the canopy structure and provides better airflow. We do have a very good fact sheet on that particular disease, both early blight and also septorial leaf spot. If you go to my website, which is pddc.wisc.edu, and look in the publication section under vegetables and look for septoria, septoria, or early blight. And it'll describe the recommendations that I've talked about here.
And what's that site again? It's
pddc.wisc.edu.
Okay.
And don't be afraid to thin those tomatoes out.
Right.
You said close together, but way too many branches on them too. Thin them out. Get the airflow.
Right.
We have Steve in East Dubuque, Illinois, up next. Hi, Steve. Thank you for calling.
I got an ornamental pear tree. You know, it just gets the little bitty pears on it.
Yep.
And it's only grown branches on the one side, and I kind of thinned it out there a little bit here this spring, cut off some of the lower branches, about 20 feet tall. And when I was out there, I noticed that there's something eating under the bark, which I think is why it's not growing on the one side. But I can't find this stupid little thing to know what it is. What do I put on there to kill it?
Well, I'm not sure that it's actually the insects that are causing the problem. My guess is that it could be a bacterial disease that's very similar to fire blight on apples. It's just a little different bacterium that occurs on plums and peaches. And if there's an insect under the bark, I suspect that the disease actually is what killed off that side of the tree and that the insects are just coming in under the bark because it's a nice protected area. So it may not be the insect that's causing the problem. And before I would make any sort of recommendation on a pesticide, and particularly an insecticide, you definitely need to find those insects and get a sample into someone who can identify them for you, because there is some possibility that maybe it is an actual insect pest that's causing the problem, but you need that identified before you apply a pesticide.
You also need to take a look at whether that tree was planted correctly also.
Yeah, because there could be girdling roots that might be killing off a portion of the tree.
And often what you'll see is a flat side on a trunk.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm really concerned because it's only growing on half of the tree that, you know, that could be this bacterial canker.
Okay. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Liz, we got an email from Andy. I'm a first-time home buyer and would like to plant an apple tree in the backyard, have my option of sunlight exposure. Is there a species that has a good track record for staying free of pests and disease? What do you think?
Yeah, Laura has got, Laura Joel on campus here has got a great publication. Do you remember what the name of that
is? Was this crab apples or apples?
An apple tree. So I assume it's an apple.
Oh, I was thinking ornamental. I was thinking ornamental.
There
is still a fantastic publication that was put together by the horticulture department that has great fruits on it. And it really depends on what you're looking for. Are you looking for early fruit? Are you looking for dwarf? And usually you do want a dwarf stock for the average homeowner. There are a lot of good ones out there. Jonna Gold is good. Is it Jonna Gold?
I don't know the varieties of apples.
Yeah, I know. I used to know them. I used to do a lot of fruit. What I would suggest to you is to go to the website, the Hort website.
Yep. And I can give that one out, too.
Excellent. Go ahead and do that.
It's learningstore.uwex.edu. And that's the UW Extension Publications Office website. And if you look under fruit crops, there's, I believe it's called Growing Apples in Wisconsin. And it's a lovely, it's about $4 or $5, but it's a lovely booklet that has recommendations on varieties. It tells you how to prune the trees. It tells you how to plant them. It tells you about treatment schedules to prevent pest problems. So it's really, quite frankly, worth the money.
And I wasn't trying to fob you off with not giving you a recommendation. The reason why I say to take a look at that is really depends on what you want them for. If you want them for fresh eating, that's a different apple. If you want them for freezing, for
cooking,
whatever. Yeah, whatever it is, there are different characteristics. And you need to take a look at what exactly your end use is and then kind of go from there.
And if you go to that website, you don't have to buy the publication if you don't want to, although I do recommend buying this one because I think it's a nice reference. You can actually look at it online. There's a PDF version that you can look, and the information is there. That's an excellent reference. And they have similar ones on, I think, on growing berry fruits and plums, cherries, and peaches. They all have a very similar look. They're about the same price. And for anyone thinking of growing those particular crops, I really recommend those because they've done an excellent job putting those together.
And really pay attention to the areas of Wisconsin. Some are better in southern Wisconsin. Some are better in northern. And you can kind of play with that a little bit if you've got a microclimate. But I would take a look at the workload involved in it, too, so that you know how many trees you want to put in. If it's something you just want to play with and you're okay with sacrificing quality, you might choose something that's got a little less in the resistance area, but it will give you a fruit that you can actually use with a lot less work.
There you go. Thank you very much for that email. We have Dorothy in Green Bay with a question. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I just thought I'd ask you about my cherry tree.
Okay.
It's about 5 or 6 years old. It's a pie cherry type. The tree is beautiful. 2 years ago, it started blooming. And both last year, the cherries started to develop, and then they all turned black and just withered up.
Mm-hmm. Were they small when they withered up? How large were they?
They were pretty good size. You know, they weren't ripe yet, but I was, eagerly awaiting ripened cherries, and then they just turned black.
Yeah, isn't that frustrating? Did they get kind of any fuzzy material on the surface at all?
Excuse me, I didn't hear.
Did they get any sort of kind of buff-colored fuzzy material on the surface after they kind of shriveled up?
No.
Did you notice?
Turned black.
Okay.
Black and withered.
I've had people ask me about that one in the past, and depending on how the conditions are when that happens, it may just be a brown rot of some sort.
That was what I was talking about before. Usually I see kind of a buff-colored fuzz on the fruits after they shrivel up like that. That's why I'm not sure that's what it is.
Well, it depends on the conditions, because to me, some of the stuff that I've seen, it definitely is. But if we get damp or just kind of weird, heavy air, very moist, I sometimes see that too, where I don't think it's necessarily the spores. It may be something else from the environment that's causing that kind of look to it.
If it were a drier year, I would suggest possible drought stress sort of issues because the fruits will dry up because of that. If they were very small when they started to do that, it could be poor pollination.
And I would also look at what you're doing in your lawn because you can actually get some damage on the fruit depending on what you put on for lawn chemicals. And also, what your neighbors are putting on.
Chemicals.
Okay.
Your neighbors might. And there is a lot of drift that's associated with some of the chemicals, depending on what the temperatures are. So if you get revolatilization of chemicals, they can actually drift and it can actually cause the fruit to dry up if it hits at the right time. The chances of that are small. Excuse me. I have to apologize. I've got a bit of a cold today, so poor Larry and Brian having to deal with me. But that can potentially be an issue. And things that will cause fruit drop, 7. So if somebody is using that around, potentially can. They can do it.
There you go.
I would definitely, I think, clean up any of those fruits just in case it is brown rot, because that if it's wet again this year, if you've got all of those shriveled fruits and the fungus is there, you're going to have a problem again. So real good cleanup of any of those small shriveled fruits, whether they're on the ground or hanging on the tree, I would do any of those. And then just hope for no rain when it's when the trees are flowering, because that can prevent pollination. Those would be my current recommendations based on what I can tell from what you've described.
If it happens again, I would suggest sending a sample into Bryant at the lab so he can take a look at it.
Yeah, we could also look for potential insects that might be laying eggs or colonizing and causing some fruit abortion as well.
I would think she'd probably see insect activity, but if you disappear for 3 days, that might be the 3 days when you can see them. So it's you never can tell.
Thanks a lot for calling, Dorothy. Appreciate your call. And by the way, Judith has already put up the links to the Wisconsin Arborist Association.
Excellent.
So we got a comment. Got that now on our Facebook page on the comments section on the status for today's show. It's also up on the Larry's Links page on WPR.org. So we have that listed for you. And Jan in La Crosse, we are up to you now. Hi, Jan. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted them to comment on something. It seems to me, and I'm an old-time gardener, that each year I have more disease to fight. You got to wash your, shears and things off with an alcohol and all these other things. And I just don't remember it this bad, and it just seems to grow.
Yeah, I've had other people comment to me on that, there may be some truth with that. I think there are more folks gardening. There are more people living close together. Mm-hmm. So if more people are growing plants, you've got more likelihood of, if there are diseases, that they're going to spread more easily. So I think that may be part of it. It could be that some of the varieties that are being developed, sometimes they're being developed for particular horticultural characteristics, size of fruit, color of fruit, something of that sort. And so in the breeding process, folks may not be looking at diseases. And so you end up with these plants that have the right horticultural characteristics in terms of size and that sort of thing, but don't necessarily have a lot of disease resistance. I think some of the benefit, hundreds of years ago, was just growing plants over and over again in a particular location, and you just kind of naturally selected for resistance, what we call field resistance. And again, with a lot of hybrids, we may be losing some of that advantage as well. So I think there are a variety of reasons why.
But I think losing diversity also, you don't get the perpetual environment that's going to breed resistance, as you said. But then I think we don't have the variety in our yards to actually counteract it.
Right.
So you have to have the whole ecosystem.
There's a whole line of research where people look at intercropping and actually interspersing plants of different types as folks are growing vegetables. And what that tends to do is provide a physical barrier for movement of pathogens in the garden. You can have the same density of plants, but if you cluster them together versus having them spread apart, you can get different levels of disease. You tend to get less when they're spread and have other types of plants around them. So,
and we really used to have a lot more of those rows between fields and things like that, which would help break that up tremendously. Mm-hmm. We don't with the type of farming that's going on now.
Yeah, it's very intense nowadays. So I think that promotes more problems with the disease.
And thank you again for calling, Jan. Appreciate your call. Visiting about identifying, treating, and preventing plant diseases today with our two guests, Brian Hoddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology, and Liz Freemuth, who is previously a horticulturist for Walworth County, now the owner of the company The Garden Hoe, a passion for healthy and happy plants. She provides concierge horticulture services. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on this edition of Garden Talk as we visit with Liz Freemuth and Brian Hoddleston about plant disease issues. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@WPR.org. And Liz, before we go back to the phones, I went to your website, thegardenhoe.com, right?
Yes, yes. And it is thegardenhoe.com. There is only one, and it is me.
Definitely. Having known Liz for many years, there is only one.
And the whole entire universe is saying, thank goodness there's only one. Yeah, it is a pretty website. Actually, go down to the bottom of the page. It's really kind of cute. I have a great web designer. And yeah, isn't that awesome? And
some
on there,
roots on the bottom there?
Yeah, yeah, handle it all. So everything from the top to the bottom. And we've got a link on there. Brian and I have just started, and we're in the novice newbie stage of doing it. We do live stream on about every other Saturday. We shoot for it, depending on what the schedule's like. And if you want to see us making fools of ourselves, yeah, that's a good way to do it. Yeah, yeah. And we love plants. We love talking about them.
Thegardenhoe.com. All right.
If you go to Garden Hoe, you may get something kind of interesting. So you want to remember there's only one. Go to thegardenhoe.com.
All right. Well, let's go to Debbie in Loganville. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. Is this Debbie in Loganville that you wanted?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. I have a question about my strawberries. Okay. I have both, I think, both leaf spot and leaf blight. And I'm wondering whether it would be better to use something to spray with Bacillus subtilis or to spray with a copper fungicide.
I would personally probably go with the copper fungicide as long as it's labeled for strawberries.
Okay.
You need to make sure you get a formulation that's labeled for strawberries. Sounds like you're trying to do this organically. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, yeah. And are you certified organic or just kind of generally organic?
I'm too small. Otherwise, I would be certified
organic. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because not all copper-containing products are the same for certified organic. Just to let you know, it depends on how they're manufactured. So if you kind of want to have the philosophy of certified organic, you may want to search around and find one that's technically okay for certified organic. But the copper-containing products, I think, will work a little bit better for you than the Bacillus subtilis. I know there are some spray applications for that particular. It's actually a bacterium. Mm-hmm. But I think of that typically as a little bit better as a seed treatment rather than as a spray.
Oh, okay.
Cost-wise, if it's a seed treatment, it's going to be probably a bit prohibitive as a leaf treatment.
Yeah, it's. I think you'll be able to find some copper-containing products that will work quite well for you. You may want to pretest those before you spray them wholesale. Copper can be a little bit toxic to leaf tissue, so you may get some burn symptoms, and particularly if you're applying it when it's hot. And definitely I wouldn't go for straight copper sulfate, which you can find on occasion. If you're going to try that particular active ingredient, I would get it in a formulation called Bordeaux mix. Again, make sure whatever you're buying says that you can use it on strawberries. Bordeaux mix has some lime mixed in with it, and that tends to ameliorate some of those problems with burn. That's the granddaddy of the fungicides, by the way, the first one ever developed. And it actually wasn't developed as a fungicide. It was developed as an anti-pilfering compound. It was used by grape growers in France because they'd grow their grapes along roads and people would come and steal the grapes. And so they applied the copper sulfate and lime in order to make them taste bad. And they found that they had fewer problems with downy mildew when they did that.
Very interesting.
It's a kind of
happy
a cool story.
Happy accident. Yeah. Yes.
A lot of things have been discovered that way.
Thanks again for calling, Debbie. Appreciate it. We've got an email from Margo. I've read that a fungicide will control or minimize rust on hollyhock leaves. Would you agree with this method? And if so, what fungicide would you use?
Yeah, there are several. My question again with hollyhocks and rust is how attached are you to that particular hollyhock?
Yeah.
Because it's a lot of effort really to treat for rust.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't really care for that particular hollyhock, I would say look for some of the newer varieties that are rated as resistant for rust. And they will advertise them as such because that is a serious enough disease on that particular type of plant that they definitely will advertise resistance. Now, if you want to spray, I'd have to double check to make sure exactly what's labeled, but I'm pretty sure something like chlorothalonil probably is. That's an active ingredient. What I would suggest for you on that one, because I'm not up specifically on the fungicide treatments for that particular host, would be to email me, and I can look up specific information for you. And my email is B as in boy, D as in dog, H as in Harry, at plantpath, P-L-A-N-T-P-A-T-H, that's all one word, dot W-I-S-C dot edu. And you know, I'm up on some of the fungicides, but I like to check those before I give formal recommendations because things do change. Definitely you want to do good cleanup. If you're having problems, that'll help so you don't have to apply those fungicides as often because that rust is, as I recall, is an autoecious rust, which means it only has one host. It's not like cedar apple rust that bounces back and forth between junipers and apple trees or hawthorns. It basically completes its entire life cycle on hollyhock. And so good fall cleanup is going to be at least help you a little bit. And if you do end up making those fungicide applications, they need to be put on very, very early because you need to catch it before the first infections occur, and that can be very, very early in the growing season. So as soon as they start to sprout, I would start applying.
I would even suggest trying moving it because
Better airflow certainly, again, is another issue good drying.
It may only reduce the issue, but it might reduce it enough that you're okay with it.
Right.
Yeah.
But definitely think of a newer variety. But of course, a lot of folks have, you know, grandma's old variety,
exactly.
And they have sentimental value.
Exactly.
And with those, then you do have to consider other types of strategies for control other than replacement. Mm-hmm.
And if that doesn't work, plant something taller in front of it. Because then you can't see the rust. You know, just go for something that's a little more rust resistant to go in front of it.
But definitely for that particular person, or if you have questions afterwards, I shouldn't say just that person. If anyone has questions after the show, you're welcome to email me. I'll probably have a deluge of emails when I get back to the lab, but that's okay. That's what we're here for. So, and like I said, sometimes I don't know the specifics, particularly on some of the pesticides that you can use. So I need to look those up just to verify.
And we had a Facebook comment from my Facebook page from Patty wanting you, Brian, to talk about your upcoming appearance at the annual educational Fond du Lac Master Gardener Day in the garden, April 2nd.
Yes, it's on April 2nd, and I'm trying to think which talk I'm actually giving for that particular program because I give
it's
several.
It's not April 2nd yet,
I've actually sent them that particular PowerPoint, so they have it. I'm actually way ahead, which is unusual. I think it's a vegetable talk with organic controls for that particular particular program. It's, I think, called Day in the Garden. I'm sorry I don't have specifics on that. Caught me a little bit off guard, but I think it's called Day in the Garden. It is in Fond du Lac. It's on April 2nd. I believe I'm on sometime in the afternoon around 1, although I'd have to check my calendar on that. And Phil Pelletier, I think, is also going to be there. Mm-hmm. So he's going to be talking on insects. But if you have questions about diseases, definitely come and see us. And I'm not sure whether there's a fee or anything for that, but definitely folks who are interested could give the Fond du Lac County office a call, the extension office, and they should be able to provide details on that.
Excellent. Let's go to Paul in Lac du Flambeau next. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Evans pie cherry trees. They started getting covered with powdery mildew last year, right around the time of fruiting, and then after the trees fruited, it was just decimated. The leaves are just covered and covered. Trying to head it off this spring, what and when do I
did
do something
you
this?
See a lot of leaf loss or a lot of reduction in fruit set on the tree?
The fruit set was okay. The leaves would turn white and then curl up and lost lots of leaves during the summer months.
So it was severe enough that you were actually getting some leaf loss. That's somewhat unusual for a lot of powdery mildews. Usually don't get it quite that severe. What you probably will want to do, if you haven't done any pruning recently, would be to do some pruning in that tree to open up the canopy. Powdery mildews like really humid conditions.
Okay.
So if you've got a dense canopy, you know, no rain, but a real dense canopy to trap a lot of moisture, that tends to really promote those particular types of diseases.
Is it in full sun or does it get partial sun during the day?
Full sun. I think
we had lots of rain last summer, though.
Yeah,
and that's we saw a lot of powdery mildews. I was a little surprised because usually when we get a ton of rain, we don't get a lot of powdery mildew because it doesn't like wet leaves. It likes dry leaves but high humidity.
Something to spray on there or no?
I would say try for the time being. I would try the pruning to open the canopy. I think you might be able to get good enough control doing that
you
would
small
not
trees. They're only 7
well,
8 feet high.
You know what I would suggest. Just also, it's in the pruning vein, is not just those, but take a look around the yard to see if there are other trees, shrubs, etc., that you can prune out to increase that airflow in that area. Especially if you're talking about a 7-foot tree, you really need to look at what's around it to make sure that it's not in a pocket of dead air, and you really
want
air to
good
be flowing
suggestion.
Through.
Much in an open area.
Okay, clean up the old leaves from last year. Get rid of those. That's where, in part, the powdery mildew fungus is likely coming from. If you desperately want to try to spray something, that I would recommend kind of a home remedy that we recommend that's based on some research out of Cornell University.
And the mixture is a tablespoon and a half of baking soda and 3 tablespoons of a lightweight horticultural oil.
Huh.
It should say lightweight horticultural oil.
Cooking oil.
Yeah, well,
horticultural
well
oil.
some people try to use cooking oils, but you do need to pretest those because they can be too heavy in oils if they're too heavy, and if it's hot can cause some burn symptoms. But if you get the commercial product that's a lightweight horticultural oil, the brand that we typically are able to find around here is Sunspray Oil, and they have a lightweight line. And apply that. You need to get it on before you see symptoms. That's mixed in a gallon of water. And you spray that on before you start to see symptoms. So if you have a good idea when it started last year, go out about 3 weeks before that and start applications. And it'd be about every 7 to 14 days.
Just going to bother bees?
No, that's one of the reasons why I recommend this particular concoction, because it's fairly low impact.
It is proven.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. There's
I was in a garden for them online about a month ago, and someone told me to spray them with milk.
Well, there is some evidence that some types of milks will work, but it's usually not very good control.
Okay.
So that's not something I recommend. I think you'll get better success with the baking soda. And actually, if you look commercially...
I think baking soda's cheaper anyway.
Yeah, if you look commercially, there are actually commercial variants of this that have potassium bicarbonate instead of sodium bicarbonate as the active ingredient. Baking soda is sodium bicarbonate. Mm-hmm. But try that. Again, you've got to get those applications on early, though, to have them be successful.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking about identifying, treating, and preventing plant diseases today with our guest, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison, and Liz Freemuth, who has previously a horticulturist for Walworth County, now owner of The Garden Hoe. Go to thegardenhoe.com to find out some more about her. Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Brian Huddleston of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. Liz Freemuth, who has a business called The Garden Hoe. And you can go online to thegardenhoe.com. She is a provider of concierge horticultural services. And as you listen to her, you'll know that she knows a whole lot. So it's great to have her along as we talk plant diseases with both Brian and with Liz. Join in at 1-800-642-1234, email talk@wpr.org, and we will go to Jamie in Madison for a call. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call and for the program.
Sure.
I'm calling about 2 fruit trees. One is a plum tree and one is an apple tree. And both of them have problems. The plum tree has fruit rot, and I have apple maggots on the apple tree. And I have treated them with spray in the past, but never completely gotten rid of either problem. And I don't know if I'm not, spraying as often as I should. I guess I've been spraying about once a month, but it doesn't seem to be enough.
Yeah, the fruit rot on your plum, again, is probably this brown rot disease that we talked about earlier. One of the things I would definitely do is scour around the base of those trees and any place where the fruit may have dropped. Because, again, the initial spores for that disease are coming out of those mummified fruits that have been infected. So you definitely need to get rid of those. In terms of the fruit sprays, as long as you have something that's been labeled for control of brown rot, they should work, but you may want to start applications a little bit earlier and make them more frequently, because once a month sounds a little bit...
It's not enough.
Not enough. Definitely you do need to check the label of the product that you're using, because it could be that you have a product that only allows you to spray once a month, but most of them oftentimes have a 7 to 14 day interval for application. And again, you need to make those applications, because the fruits are going to be increasing in size. And as new tissue is formed, that new tissue isn't going to be protected by the fungicide that you made a couple of weeks ago or a month ago. So you need to get additional material on the fruits.
And you also need to look at adding to that spray program something for insects. If you are going to be on a spray program, go whole hog, because otherwise, if you're not using any kind of preventative insect treatment, you know, whatever you choose, organic, non, you may actually be allowing those insects to open the fruit up, which will allow problems. Yeah, which will create more of an issue. So you do want to be proactive 100%. And that doesn't mean it has to be heavy duty insecticide.
Right.
It can actually be a very kind of good. It might even be, you know, fungus. A lot of the fungicides will have insecticide in them when they're for fruit.
The fruit sprays in particular oftentimes are a combination of fungicide and insecticide. So definitely, if you're using one of those, you'll probably cover the fairly full spectrum of what you might encounter. For apple maggot, I'm not sure. Do you know any recommendations for that? That's outside of my area of expertise. That would be something where I would give Phil Pelletieri a shout.
If this is home, and it is, you can go to the publication that the Horticulture Department has put out, and it will tell you right on there what to use for apple maggot. And you may have to kind of search around a little bit because, you know what, I'm going to be honest, I don't know what the product is that you do for that. But I do know that you need to start all of these like before now, because we have buds in kind of expansion phase, and some of them I saw, I was absolutely amazed at that they are beyond really heavy. They are starting to open up. Once you get past that point, sometimes you can't get control of a problem that's been there for a number of years. You have to start very, very early.
Yeah, so definitely check out the Apple publication that we talked about earlier. That should have some information on apple maggot. And again, that was at the Learning Store website. So
there's a nice one page for the homeowner that will list out the time that you have to do it and the product and what it does treat, which insect it does treat.
And if you can't find that information, email me and I'll look it up for you and send you a link. And again, my email is bdh@plantpath.wisc.edu, W-I-S-C.edu. You're welcome to email me.
I would have to take a look also at product info, because I know with one of my clients in years past, they had a mix of fruit in an orchard. And you do have to be very careful in the products that you use, because some are harmful to one fruit, they're not harmful to another. So you may have to stagger those sprays. You may have to really go to different products that are available. And, you know, those products change every time you walk into the store. There may be something new on the shelf. But, you know, I'm equally open to, you can email me and I'm, you know, either Brian or I, and happy to answer it for you, look it up.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see, Brian, you mentioned earlier you gave your email address and you put, and it's BDDC.
Oh, the website is PDDC, so that stands for Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic, .wisc, W-I-S-C, short for Wisconsin, .edu.
Okay.
And if you go to that website, my contact information is there as well. So
okay.
And with mine, you can just go to the website, and there's a contact page that you can go to and fill out an email for me.
Okay, at thegardenhoe.com. Mm-hmm. On to Jim in Elkhart Lake. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. Got a problem that started on a peach tree. During late summer, it would bleed like a amber gum out the bark, and then it would, after a couple of years of trying to control with copper Bordeaux and all kinds of stuff, nothing really seemed to cure it. I pulled it out and noticed the wood on the inside was all corky, punky, and then later in that summer, I seen it appear on my cherry trees, and I'm worried that I'm going to end up losing my cherry trees and have to start over and wait more years to get fruit.
Yeah, is it in the main trunk of the trees?
Mainly.
Yeah, that's bad news. It sounds like this disease I talked about earlier, bacterial canker, and that oozing that you're talking about is a very typical symptom of that disease. It's a bacterium that gets in through wounds. Probably also there's some insect activity that's moving it around. If it's anything like fire blight, that particular bacterium is actually moved by honeybees as they pollinate. But definitely once it gets into the trees, it will cause a canker, so a localized infection, and will eventually girdle the trees. And it sounds like your peach, that's what happened with that. And it will go to cherries, goes to plums. And if it gets into the main trunk, there's not a lot that you can do about it. The spray treatments that you're talking about will not be effective, and there really aren't any that are effective once you have the disease in the tree. It's protected by the bark. You can't get the products to where they might kill off the bacteria. And bacteria in general are very difficult organisms to get under control. So if you happen to have this on a branch, you can prune the branch, and you prune back about 10 inches or 12 inches below where you see the signs of that oozy material or any signs of any symptoms at all. On a main trunk, you basically try to water the tree well, keep it as healthy otherwise, and then get fruit from it as long as you possibly can.
Sorry to be the harbinger of death here, but that one's a real tough disease to deal with.
Yeah, I have tried peaches again and again and again in my yard. I keep thinking, I'll get it right. But typically that is, in my yard, what they will die from.
Right.
You know, I think with peaches, I don't notice it.
The added thing is that they're somewhat marginally hardy here, so they're going to get some cold injury, and those wounds from the cold injury can provide the entry point for the bacterium.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, the bacterium, is Pseudomonas syringae, pathovar syringae, and that's a natural epiphyte, so it naturally occurs on leaves typically without causing disease, but that particular organism is also a pathogen. So it kind of lives on the leaves of a lot of plants naturally. It doesn't do anything other than sit there, and then it can, at high enough populations, cause problems. And that one also is the organism that causes bacterial blight on lilac as well.
Hmm. So. There you have it. Jim, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I wanted to, we have more on the Day in the Garden, April 2nd, and that's Diseases of Vegetables and Organic Control.
I guessed that one right.
Brian is going to be speaking from 1 to 2:20. And the cost for the whole day is $40. And again, where is it located at?
That's up in Fond du Lac. They'll have to send you the actual. That's far enough ahead in my future that I haven't checked on actual locations. So it is in Fond du Lac.
All right.
I'm assuming at the UW Fond du Lac campus. That's where they oftentimes have those.
Diane in East Troy, on to you now. Hi, Diane.
Hi. How are you? Good afternoon. I'm calling because I have a Meyer lemon tree that I purchased, and this is the third year we've had it. We've gotten fruit each year from it, small fruit. They're small lemons, but they're lemons. And we take it outside all summer, all the growing season, and then we bring it in. We have a four-season sunroom that gets a lot of light in the winter. And we were gone just recently for a month. I had somebody coming over just to water my plants. And when we came back, the leaves on the lemon tree were just coated with this really sticky substance. and they had like a little webbing. We noticed some webbing between
them.
Oh,
sure.
Liz?
Yeah.
We know
that one even I know.
For some strange reason, I've had a lot of experience in citrus in Wisconsin. Go figure, but I have. What you've got is a number of different things that are going to hit houseplants anyway. But on citrus trees, the sticky substance is you have scale. Is really what you're looking at. And check on the branches under the leaves. You're going to find little hard shells, and you can pick those off. If it's not too horribly large, you can actually just pick them off and get rid of them.
They're brown, kind of.
Yep. That's what's doing it. And if you're seeing other things flying around, you may have mealybugs, you may have whitefly. There's a lot of things that will hit, and they're actually going to be a problem until you move it outside, it just given other houseplants. But I will tell you, it doesn't take a citrus tree out, and especially a Meyer lemon. And, you know, I'm a little worried that you had small fruit on your Meyer lemon, because they're really, really tough, and you should get a decent-sized lemon off of that, even moving it in and out. What I would suggest, and you said you've had this for a few years already?
This will be the third winter, yeah.
Okay. So what I would suggest to you is to take it out of the pot and take a look at the roots. And citrus are extremely tolerant of abuse from us heavy-handed gardeners. So get yourself a nice tarp out, and I would do it maybe in about another 3 weeks or so and give it a chance to rebound before you start moving it back outside. Get a tarp. Pull it out of the pot, take a look at the roots. If they're circling around the pot, do some hack and whack on those roots. And I mean that hack and whack. Take a pruners, disinfested, you know, use bleach if they look a little wicked, the 10-20% bleach solution, and make sure your tools are clean. But cut those roots back, and if it's in a clay pot, make sure that you rinse that and soak it in a 10% bleach solution as well. And you can do that in the bathtub or kitchen sink, something like that. If it's in plastic, replace that with something that you can disinfest. And so go out and get yourself a nice clay pot that you can move in and out. And
those lightweight pots, they look like they're pottery, but they're not. So
no.
I think they're like product or something like that. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, no, don't do it. If that's what it's in, go and get a clay pot because you want longevity out of this and you want the ability to keep all of those pathogens to a minimum. So what you really want to do is get it into a container that year after year you can clean and reliably so. And a clay pot is a good way to do that. And then you get new soil in there and put it back in. And right about this time of the year, you should be getting some blooms on it, are you?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thin it out. Thin the whole thing out. What you're looking at doing is removing a lot of the interior branches. You really want this to produce fruit. You don't want it to look frou-frou-y unless you don't want fruit. Then go ahead. And you can shear it with a clippers and you're fine. But otherwise, clear out those interior branches. Get the most sunlight you can to those blossoms. And you can actually twice a year just be really wicked and whack off about a third of the growth. And I'm talking about canopy growth. Just whack it off about the same time that you do the root pruning. And they actually will do quite well. Now, citrus like to be somewhat dry, and so don't water them without fail every other day or you will kill it. It will die. It just doesn't like that. So you want the top half inch to inch to be dry almost all the time. And with that, you know, little fertilizer, there are fertilizers that are made for citrus trees. It is a different blend than what you use for houseplants, etc. So you need to go and get one for citrus trees. Then also, check your pH. They will tolerate a little bit higher pH, but check the pH of your water, and you may have to adjust that slightly while you get it back and get it, you know, kind of growing and doing wonderfully. For now, horticultural oil will take care of a lot of the problems on the leaves, et cetera, except for the scale. That you'll have to kind of pick off.
Yeah, it sounded like maybe some spider mites, too, from the webbing.
Spider mites, yeah. And, you know, if you...
It was called eight.
Pardon me?
You sprayed it with something called eight?
Yeah, it was an insecticide.
Mm-hmm. And did it do any good?
Well, we just got back a week ago, so I've done it twice. I did it last week, and I did it this week. No.
Is eight, and I'm not familiar with that product, is that labeled for fruit, for edibles? That's one of the key things that you want to do when you're spraying something that has a product on it that you're going to eat.
Okay.
A lot of them have systemic sustainability like for a very long time. So you want to make sure that it is labeled for edible products before using it. Either that or whatever fruit you're going to harvest. You know, check the label. It will tell you pre-harvest. It will say PHI on the label, and that's pre-harvest interval. Check that if you're good. If it's 60 days, you're not going to pick the fruit for 60 days, you're good. But otherwise, you can use horticultural oil to get some of that out. Insecticide generally does not take care of mites. It's a different critter.
Okay. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we had an email from Jennifer in De Pere, and they had a few maple trees planted in their property. One of them has been losing branches for a couple of years. Recently noticed some of the dead and dying branches have what looks like a fungus growing. Imagine that this is the fungus that's killing our tree one branch at a time. I'm concerned that it'll spread to the healthy trees. They're planted close together. The topmost branches almost touch each other. Is it possible for a fungus to move from one tree to another? Not concerned about saving the tree as we have plans to cut it down anyway.
Okay. Certainly, yeah, fungi can move from tree to tree. I'm not convinced for certain that the fungus that you're seeing is actually the fungus that's causing the problem, because if the branches have been dead for a while, there are a variety of fungi that are in the environment that will colonize dead wood. So that may be what she's seeing. She mentioned it was a silver maple. And my first thought was maybe there might be some verticillium issue, wilt issues on that, but silver maple tends not to have a big problem with that particular disease. So there could be canker diseases, but oftentimes those particular organisms that cause the cankers aren't real visible. What I would suggest, if you want to know what it is, would be to submit a sample through your county extension office. Get it to my lab so we can check for sure. It might be nice to know whether what you're seeing is growing in the branches is actually something serious that might move to other more important trees.
trees. But yeah, fungi can move around quite readily. They produce spores, and those are oftentimes windborne. So you do have to be careful, and oftentimes they'll go in through wounds, pruning cuts in particular. So,
and some are species specific and some are not.
Some are not. Some are more general pathogens that will go to several different types of trees. Others are fairly specific to a particular type of tree.
There we go. Could Marilyn wonders if you could repeat your home recipe for powdery mildew.
Yeah. The other thing that I'll suggest is that you go to my website and go into the publications section and look under, well, you can look under trees, vegetables, or herbaceous ornamentals, because we have powdery mildew fact sheets kind of tailored for all three of those. And that recipe is in those powdery mildew fact sheets. But just to give it over the air again, it's a tablespoon and a half of baking soda, 3 tablespoons of a lightweight horticultural oil, and that's mixed in 1 gallon of water, applied as a preventative treatment before symptoms are observed. Okay. Definitely do not use dormant oil as the oil. Do not use motor oil as the oil, which we have had people
don't.
Do.
Yeah, that will people kill think oil is oil. And
yeah,
it,
it's
and
not. It's
not.
Got to be a lightweight, yeah. highly refined oil.
Neil and Cameron, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good.
Or afternoon. Say, I installed installed a new lawn at our new house here a couple years ago, and we hauled in about 12 truckloads of very, very black dirt. It was from a farmyard, actually, is what it was, dried out, of course. It was essentially almost like compost. Our grass grew like mad for the first year. But then we started noticing discolorations, and after close examination, it appears that it has, in certain areas, larger areas, rust is what it mm-hmm. appears
yeah.
like.
Okay. That was pretty common last yeah. year.
It's wet. Mm-hmm. Well, fungal diseases in general were common last year.
Okay.
So you think you have a rust problem.
Yes. And so I purchased it's a product called Honor Guard PPZ, and it's, I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's, I'll try and pronounce this, propiconazole or something.
Propiconazole, yeah.
you actually were pretty good.
Yeah,
that was not bad.
Bad.
Not bad.
I would not actually apply that. I think there are easier, less environmentally unfriendly ways of dealing with that disease.
Okay.
One is to look around in your area for any buckthorn. Do you know what buckthorn looks like by any chance?
I do not, but I can find out.
Yeah, definitely. We have a nice publication. There's yeah. a nice publication, I think, through our learning store office on buckthorn. You want to get rid of the buckthorn trees that are anywhere close to your yard, because this particular rust is one that goes back and forth between two different types of plants, and it goes to your grass, and it spends part of its life on buckthorn. And it's actually the spores coming off the buckthorn that are infecting your turf, at least initially. So you want to get rid of the buckthorn. And then the other thing I would do would just give the lawn a shot of nitrogen fertilizer, yeah. because yeah. oftentimes that'll be enough to get the disease into at a reasonable level, and then mow routinely, because that removes the spores that can reinfect the plants.
And I might suggest also that when you mow, if you've got rust on the lawn, make sure you rinse your mower off between mowings.
Right.
The underside of the deck, the entire mower, actually, because they can rest almost anywhere.
Right,
and
you may want to mow the healthy area first of your lawn, and then mow the section of your lawn with the rust last, and then do the cleaning.
And when you're looking at applying nitrogen, you're looking at Memorial Day before you do that. You may actually see a little bit of rust starting before that. You know, a few weeks is not going to make that much of a difference, but to go really early, you're not going to do that much good. And it will stress the grass out a little bit too much. So, you know, shoot for around Memorial Day.
Yeah, so
okay.
I would not recommend the fungicide at this point, because I think that's overkill at this point.
Okay. Okay, that's great. Now, should I also be bagging?
Yes.
It's a large lawn, so it's going to be kind of a process to do this, but should I bag it?
Yes, if you can possibly do that, that would be a great idea, because then you can physically remove those contaminated clippings out of the yard, and you aren't returning them mm-hmm. into the grass where the spores can reinfect.
At least in the rust
area. In the rust areas,
definitely,
yes.
Is it the entire yard that's rusty?
Well, it's getting larger. I know last year,
yeah,
even
good.
Though we had a very good growing season, we were mowing our grass about every 3 days, because mm-hmm. that's how much it grows.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Raise the blade up a little bit, too, 3.5 inches. You'll mow a little bit less often, but that will actually help reduce a bit of the stress on the grass also.
And there we go. And with that, we are out of time. Boy, it flew. Thank you so much.
Fun.
I tell you, we had a great time. Liz, you'll come back and see us again?
As often as you'd like.
Okay. And Brian, you'll be back.
Certainly.
Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. Liz Freemuth, who has a business called The Garden Hole. Go to thegardenhole.com, find out more about that. And thank you for listening on Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.